Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Anthony, welcome to The Critic podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
So, Anthony, would you just like to introduce yourself quickly to our vast listenership?
Yes, I would. My name's Anthony Broxton. I've written for The Critic for a couple of years now on a range of things, really, but my background is a historian of the Labour Party and post-war Britain, and it was a delighted to be able to have a look at the 1997 election. I run a blog called The Tides of History and a social media page, which has looked at Labour Party history, but specifically a focus on opposition and what the party can kind of do to, you know, improve its standing. So I think the 97 election is a good place to look. I'm delighted to discuss with you today.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, so just for context, Sunday, 1st of May, will represent the 25th anniversary since the 1997 election, in which New Labour swept power, and we're all living in the aftermath one way or another. So Anthony, did anyone see it coming?
I think everybody saw a Labour victory coming, but not the size of it. And a lot of that was to do with the fact, something else that I wrote for The Critic last month was the 1992 election, where Labour had been ahead in the polls for a long time. They've been in the lead for the polls for probably about 4 years, at some points by 20 points, and had managed to lose that election for a whole range of factors, many of which are still not agreed on. Some think it was the campaign, some think it was the leadership, some think it was the media. By 1997, when Labour was ahead in the polls again, they were 20 points ahead come the election. There were still many, many people, including Tony Blair himself, that didn't think it was possible that so many Conservative voters would actually vote Labour. And I think on election day or election night, the Times ran a front page that was basically saying that Labour are going to win by a landslide. And famously, Alistair Campbell and Tony Blair rang up someone from the Times and said, you can't print that, because if you print that, there's a good chance that people aren't going to go out and vote. So there was definitely a nervousness, and the scale of the victory, nobody really saw that happening. Mm.
So the campaign was also one of the nastier campaigns in British politics in some respects. You had things like the New Labour, New Danger ad run. What did you make of that?
New Labour, New Danger. I think it was Steve Hilton behind that one. And it was that was an attempt, I suppose, to run again what had happened in the 1980s and early 1990s. The Conservatives got quite good at the kind of Labour attack lines, particularly again, 1992, they ran on the tax bombshell and various other, you know, what you call negative attack ads to support their wider arguments about their economic proposals and the rest of it. If you actually go back and look at that 1997 election, which I have done, John Major comes across like a totally different character than you kind of think of him today. He's very much talking about, this is the most important election in the history of Britain, and if you let Labour back in, we're going to be living in a very different country. You can't trust them. They're going to give up all these powers to Europe. They're going to give up all these powers to Scotland. It's very dangerous. He talks about Tony Blair being a fraud. He's one of the more ferocious critics of New Labour. Now, that might be because, you know, that's politics and he was in a desperate situation. But I think if you look back at it now, you would probably, even if you asked him, he'd say they weren't really fooling anyone with the kind of like negative attacks. Labour had done so much in the previous years to kind of win over Conservative voters, not just through policy, but as I write in the Critic piece this week, Tony Blair had spent a good chunk of his career trying to work out ways to appeal to Conservative voters, whether it was small investors talking about how they should be protected in the stock market because they were actually people who were spending redundancy money. You know, these are the kind of things that Labour politicians normally aren't comfortable talking about. So Tony Blair had good stock in the Conservative media, which always helps a Labour leader. Not many have that opportunity. I think it was as early as 1990 that the Daily Telegraph had kind of identified Tony Blair as someone who would be a potential leader. But now everyone thinks, oh, it was Gordon Brown who was always going to be the leader. But there was definitely discussions about Blair in non-Labour circles about how he was a very different politician. So I think by the time you get to 1997, and those attack lines that he was going to do X, Y, and Z, and that there was a brigade of lefties, I think I saw read yesterday, that was one of the attacks. It just wasn't going to work. And part of that was also that aspects of the left had very much detached themselves from the New Labour project. People like Tony Benn, Jeremy Corbyn, Arthur Scargill even set up his own political party. That was all benefiting Labour when it came to them saying that we're not the party that we kind of used to be.
So, I mean, I'm interested to say, I mean, you know, all of these negative attack lines worked in 1992, and they didn't work in 97 because, as you said, Blair had done all of this work in the meantime. Could you say a little bit more about, you know, what were the policy changes that were changing Labour's image, and what were the messaging changes?
Yeah, I think also just before we move on to that as well, why it didn't work as much in 97 was the Conservatives had that terrible period in office in the 90s that begins with sleaze and rolls all the way on, which we can come back to. And that was also a factor as well. I think what Tony Blair did in the mid-90s was build on those changes that Neil Kinnock and John Smith had made. They'd done the heavy lifting in terms of changing the party's position on Europe, going from a party that was, you know, advocating withdrawal from the EEC to being, you know, wanting to sign the social chapter and moving towards where the country was more in that, it's hard to think now, but more people were moving towards Europe, and Labour were kind of jumping on that. They'd also changed the position on defence. And I think the most important one that kind of built Blair as a politician, one that's been talked about a lot, is how he talked about law and order, which is something that Labour could talk about capitalising at the moment. I hear Labour say, crime's going to be the thing that wins the next election because people are worried about it and all these things are happening and there's, you know, disillusionment with the Met and all these range of issues that people have with the police at the minute. But what Tony Blair did in the early 90s was actually give Labour a substantial poll lead on who's going to be the best to deal with law and order. And I think that's because, one, he was tapping into wider discontent with some of the fallout from Thatcherism, so that, you know, high welfare, a lot of single mums, that was becoming a kind of narrative in the media, and Conservative politicians were talking about it as a problem. Labour was saying, well, this is a consequence of your policies in the kind of society that you built. If you want to cut law and order and give opportunity to people, you're going to have to A, be stronger on crime, but also more opportunities, more investment in skills, cut unemployment. So Labour were kind of building a message that would hopefully that appeal to people who did care about law and order. They weren't scared of talking about it. And obviously a lot of right-wing commentators, people like Peter Hitchens, Paul Johnson, all these kind of people who've been critical of Labour, were making the same arguments that Labour were making about the need to fix crime. Tony Blair famously kind of picked up on that in the wake of James Bulger's death in Liverpool, the toddler who was murdered, and it became a huge kind of state of the nation problem, you know, inquiry about what has happened to our society. Tony Blair very much tapped into that. And I think that's one of the major turnarounds in his career and Labour's trajectory in that period, where people actually said, start to take them seriously again.
Two things that really interest me about that. So, I mean, the first question I have is, how did Blair get a hearing? So there's a sense in which, yes, all of that's great messaging, but it's not as if Labour leaders subsequently and before hadn't ever tried to do this. Why were right-wing papers willing to give Blair a chance in the way that's hard to imagine now?
It's a really good point, and it's something that Labour, I don't know how much time they really spend thinking about. It's kind of the divide between, do you take on the media, as we've seen, you know, Angela Rayner kind of do this week, which, you know, on the one hand, absolutely should be done and called out, and there's a groundswell of support for it. But it then makes you an even bigger target, and you know, over the next couple of years, that Angela Rayner is probably going to become the person that the right-wing media attack and decide that's the weak spot in Starmer's, you know, presentation of a different era, because she was a massive Corbyn supporter, and
yeah,
I don't know the polling on it, but I imagine that she's not, you know, very well, you know, popular in what you might call traditional Tory areas, and that's nothing really to do with that might be a class thing, which is something that, you know, is it should be changed, but also something that Labour kind of need to address as well. I think to go back to what was happening with Tony Blair, there was definitely a massive push to win over those media outlets. So if we go back further in time to before Tony Blair became leader, he was already writing op-eds in Daily Mail, Times. He had a column in the Times in the late 80s that anyone who's interested in the history of Tony Blair, if they are, should go and read them, because that's where he kind of develops a lot of these arguments.
Blair right archaeology.
Exactly. If I ever write the biography of Tony Blair, I will go and look at those Times columns, because that's where you kind of see, I think in the late 80s, he's talking about how crime is a working class issue. It's an issue that affects a lot of working class people, more than middle class people. And that I think he even has a line about how it's okay for us to live in this society if you're quite affluent, but the people who are going to be most affected by it are the people who are getting robbed outside Labour clubs in Trimden, which is the example that he uses. So he's kind of articulating, you know, that argument, which is very, went down well in these newspapers. So, and, you know, he had the support of Peter Mandelson when he was the communications director, pushing him out into the, to be the front man essentially for kind of the modernising wing of the party. It's very different now. It doesn't, there's so much media and so much kind of different outlets where people make a can make a message. You're not going to get a guy who has a column in a newspaper becomes, is able to shape the news in a way that Tony Blair probably could a little bit more. But I still think Labour identifying the people who can go into, like, for example, recently Labour have had a series of people present on LBC, David Lammy, Rachel Reeves and others. Then that's a good way of getting people out there, giving them a message. They can give it, they can take some of the flack from the public. They can also speak on their terms, and it's a big platform, you know, 10 o'clock on a weekday that they've been given. I think things like that will give them a fair hearing. But Tony Blair's a kind of one-off, I think, in terms of that. I think it's going to be hard to replicate.
So, I mean, it brings me to my second question, which is, that's how he's able to get a hearing in the media, but how was Blair able to get a hearing in the Labour Party? Because obviously a lot of these things are, you know, nails on a chalkboard to large elements of the left now and then, you know, tough on crime, you know, trying to outflank the Tories on the right, you know, incredibly electorally effective, but he would never have got anywhere if his own party were not backing him. So how was he able to win the argument within the Labour Party?
It's a really good question, and it's one that I suppose people can't really understand now. That, like, that, so I opened the piece, you know, the critic in Blair talking to the Sun newspaper about how he's going to be like Margaret Thatcher as a prime minister. And it's like, you can't believe that someone standing for the Labour Party would be able to go into that newspaper, say that, and still become leader. Like, it would be a scandal now. I think Keir Starmer even writing in the Sun newspaper, having previously said he wouldn't, which is another problem, but was just, it was just like a huge problem. And it was a problem for Blair. I mean, he was heavily criticised for going out to these outlets and trying to speak to them, you know, flying to speak to Rupert Murdoch. There's two things probably why he got a hearing more than usual. One, I think, is the fact that Labour had been in opposition for so long.
Yeah.
And knew they were going to lose for so long. It's hard to compare it to today in a way. Labour, and I said this on another podcast recently, they've kind of been living in a kind of, like, not delusion, but, like, they've been so close to power but being so far away from it, because we had hung parliaments, then we had the Brexit crisis, then we had COVID, and it always felt like, oh, we're really close to power. After Miliband lost, bit of a heaver back in. Same with the Cameron years, they were close. Corbyn, you know, had that result against Theresa May. People were like, we're nearly there. There's not been that real look at why they've lost and begin to articulate why they've lost. And I think once Labour start to do that, say if they were to lose again to Boris Johnson in the next election, there would probably have to be a real deep searching, you know, inquiry, including rebranding and change of policies to understand why they're still unpopular. And I still think at the minute they've got a poll lead. It's small, but it's enough to keep Starmer going as he is at the minute.
Totally dangerous thing.
Yeah, exactly. But there's kind of like, there isn't, I personally don't think there's like an urgency to really understand, you know, why the party is so unpopular in certain areas still, and why it lost Red Wall, why it has lost Scotland and can't win it back, and all these kind of things. I think by the time Tony Blair was coming to power, they were kind of ready to address those issues, and had lost so many times that they just wanted to win, essentially. And Tony Blair kind of played on that a lot. He got away with a lot more. I think the other thing that, you know, his predecessors had done the hard work as well. So he was kind of picking it up at a point where they were ready to win, and might have won anyway. And I think, yeah, so I think the other thing is just that Tony Blair was just coming at a time where he was reflecting that kind of mood for change in the country. I think now you look back and think it was kind of a continuation of Thatcherism, or that's the line that people take. Didn't feel like that at the time. People did buy into it because they thought things were going to change massively. And I think the historian Alwyn Turner talks about how the country had kind of agreed that it was going to divorce from Thatcherism in the 90s, but the election itself was just a sign of the divorce papers, which I think is a great line. And I think Labour needs to get to a position where that same thing's happening again. I'm not really sure what it is at the minute.
We'll turn to the parallels again in a moment, but could you just today sort of briefly kind of outline, you know, the build-up to the election? You know, was there a point at which the Tories realised, oh God, this is going to be worse than we ever imagined? Or was it more of a surprise?
I don't know. It's the weird thing is, like, the Labour side, there was still that cautiousness built on the history. And I think for a long time, the Conservatives as well, you'd have to ask a proper Conservative historian for the details. But I know that there was still an expectation, particularly in the media. If you look at Boris Johnson's articles from the period, for example, there's a cockiness that at the election, they'll just swing back. And that even if they do go for Blair this time for a change, because, you know, people wanted a change in 92, they just thought Major was the change and it wasn't Kinnock. But by 97, the Conservatives thought, you know, this probably will be a victory for Labour, and we'll probably come back next time. It might all fall apart. That, you know, Labour won't be able to govern. I don't think they expected the scale of the defeat. There was a lot of Conservative MPs who did move their seat, as in they moved from one constituency that they knew was going to lose, moved to another, and some of them still lost those as well. So there was definitely in the run-up clear signs that all was not well in the Conservative Party. And that, I think you can probably throw in the fact that no one challenged John Major. Well, John Redwood challenged John Major for the leadership, but there was no credible person, as there was in 1990, to go, I'll come in, I'll steady the ship. It could have been Michael Heseltine. People liked Michael Portillo a lot. The Conservatives could have found a leader potentially in 95, 96 that was more capable of taking on Blair. The fact that they didn't, I think, was a resignation from the people in the cabinet that they didn't want to fight this election. They wanted to fight the next one. Yeah. And what they realised was that they were going to be in William Hague's situation, which was going to be facing one of the biggest kind of electoral hills to climb in history.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm interested by is, I was, I think, 5 when the 1997 election happened. And I do remember, obviously, as a child, you're not really switched into any of this. But I do remember how happy my parents were. You know, they were both professors at Cambridge. They were late, you know, they were, of course, as you would imagine, Labour supporters. They'd spent most of their lives under a Tory, under seeing the Labour Party defeated. And the sense of just, like, finally something new has come along was, there was definitely a feeling of expectation. I don't know how old you are or if you have any direct memory of it.
Yeah, I was a similar age at that time.
Yeah.
So I was very young, and I kind of remember my going to school, you know, primary school, and it was sunny day, and maybe that's a fake memory, I don't know. But I feel like sunny day, everyone was happy. Particularly where I'm from in Wigan, which was like, you know, had voted Labour the whole period and not have that success. But I think it's a good point that what Labour did, and it goes back to Alwyn Turner comment, people were kind of they were so fed up with the Conservative Party. I think the Sun newspaper actually said that May the first 97 will be like winning the lottery, because we'll get rid of these, you know, sleaze and traitors and all this division. Yeah. And people genuinely felt that Tony Blair was going to bring, it seems remarkable to say it now, was going to bring the end of sleaze in politics, and that he was going to be like a clean skin. And he, you know, he obviously had the look of it. He was going to clean up politics.
Yeah.
It was going to be open government, that were going to bring in things like the Freedom of Information Act. They weren't going to be corrupt, let's say the word, as kind of the Conservatives were seen, and as many people see them today. I'll bring it back to Alwyn Turner again, because he always kind of comes up with it with the right arguments on this. He says that Tony Blair's leadership actually means that that's not possible to happen again. No one will ever trust a leader the way that people trust Tony Blair on May 1st, 1997. And that's because fundamentally our politics has changed because of Iraq and expenses scandals and even the rise of the internet, that we know more about politicians, that no one's ever going to look at a politician in the same way and go, that is the person that's going to, you know, change the country in a really positive way. I'm probably not as pessimistic as that. I think it's still within Labour's power to find a candidate that can really truly inspire people. You know, it wasn't long that we had like Obama in America that was doing things that were long thought, you know, impossible. I don't think that it's not possible, but I certainly don't think that Labour in a position at the minute whereby they're going to achieve this sort of victory, and that they're going to take large swathes of the country along to its project. There's a clear anti-conservative vote though at the minute. And they'll do very well off that probably over the next couple of years, but I don't see a situation where lots of, you know, Brexit voters, for example, who have turned against the party across the country are now going to look at Keir Starmer and go, he's going to deliver on a lot of those things that were promised in the referendum. So there's still obviously space for hope. I think the Brexit referendum was about changing the country in a positive way, and Labour need to find that message post-COVID, post-Brexit, to kind of bring the country together again. It can be done. I'm just not sure where they're at so far out from an election, to be fair, to do that.
Yes, so, and that's something about sort of the Labour's position today. But one question I'm interested in, I mean, let's put it quite provocatively. Mm. When the Tories said Labour will, you know, Labour and Blair will change Britain irrevocably and will change our side is in no ways that their voters realise, and it's going to be a disaster. Were they in some ways right? I mean, the social transformations under Blair were not like, you know, so Blair ran, as we've noted, as in some ways quite a conservative Labour leader, running from the right, promising more opportunities for an entrepreneurial direction, but also saying it's going to be tough on crime and be in some ways quite a socially conservative leader. But, you know, it's not that social liberalism was ever a secret, but I don't think anyone anticipated the scale and pace of social changes that happened under Blair, you know, whether it's demographic, whether it's in the law, whether it's the constitution.
Yeah, and I think this is the kind of Peter Hitchens argument that he's a secret Marxist or whatever, which I kind of like that idea that there was Labour were more liberal than people give them credit for, and that they don't want to talk about it. There was obviously a lot of debate around this at the time, particularly around like individual rights and freedoms and civil liberties and those kind of debates. I think the huge changes that occurred under the new Labour years are in terms of, one, the devolution settlement to Scotland, which, you know, changes the whole nature of the UK, which was obviously done in a referendum, but I think that was one thing that the Conservatives always warned about in the 90s. And in the 97 election, Major was quite right when he said that Britain will be a different place when you give devolution to Scotland on this scale. You can agree whether it was the right thing to do or not, but I think if you're on the other side where you didn't want it to happen, I think John Major's warnings were correct, and Labour's still trying to come to terms with how it wins in Scotland and how it deals with that. The second one, of course, is the relationship with the EU and in immigration, which changed, you know, not just Britain, but Labour's relationship to kind of working class voters, and that perception that they've been somewhat betrayed by, you know, uncontrolled immigration, where there was no restrictions placed on people coming in, and that people just, you know, change communities and change workplaces. And there was a sense under the new Labour years that you just had to get on with it. I think Tony Blair even made the speech famously where he just said, you know, arguing about immigration is like, or, you know, freedom of movement is like arguing about the time or the weather. I've got it wrong, but it's basically saying like there's no point in arguing about it. So I think that and those changes that happened, I still think Labour haven't really come to terms with the fact that they did, whether they want to go out and defend them or whether they want to, you know, push them further. I think you're right. I think that there were a hell of a lot of change in this country during those Labour years, and you probably wouldn't have been able to see them looking at the 97 election. Just as in 1979, you wouldn't have been able to see what was happening when Thatcher won. It was cautious in a way. And then when they get into power, they do what, you know, what they want.
I mean, do you think there's a sense in which this was both one of the last kind of old-fashioned transformational left-right, you know, switch changing of the guards in like British politics, and that we haven't really seen a decisive election in the same way since?
Well, I did want to explore this a little bit in the article. Maybe it'd be one for another time. But the kind of the way that Boris Johnson took so many Labour votes in the last election. I still don't think, again, we've come to terms with what a transformational realignment election that was. Because of COVID and Brexit and all the kind of things that were happening around it, there was no space to kind of go, this is kind of phenomenal what this guy's done. He's gone into these Labour places that was, you know, giving it the red wall tag that people don't like, but intractable for generations. You know, people talking about their grandfathers and all this, and it was wrapped in Brexit, of course. People believed that Labour had sold them out on Brexit. There's no point denying it. Labour try and claim it was XYZ. There was a lot of resentment in those areas because people had felt that they'd voted for one thing and Labour were trying to stop it. And I think that's one thing that Labour haven't come to terms with yet either, is what is the Brexit settlement going to look like. But I think Boris Johnson proved that it can be done. He went into those areas, took those voters, said, I represent your values now. He wasn't scared of going up to these areas and saying, you know, I want to win your votes. You know, the whole working to man the rugby league town thing, it's politics at the end of the day. Labour's got to go out into those areas again, Scotland and, you know, affluent parts of the South, and win people that it hasn't won since the 90s if it's going to govern with a majority of just one. So it's possible. It's possible. I'm just not sure whether Labour have got the message that can bring all three together at the minute. And that is a very hard job. I don't envy Keir Starmer in trying to do that at all. It's easy to appeal to one demographic, but the three at the same time.
We mentioned earlier a certain Labour complacency, a sense that they were near power and that they didn't need to adjust course ideologically on their messaging. And I mean, one thing I mean that's quite striking is the way that, although is that the electoral map is so different now than in 1997. I mean, Scotland has just been lost to every other party but the SNP. Seeing, you know, Labour has disappeared, not just from some of its traditional heartlands, but also from lots of seats that used to be competitive. And it's suddenly concentrated in the city. It's dominating London in a way it never has in its history. I wonder how much that London dominance is creating the complacency. Like, if you've got people who are sitting on top of a city that they completely run, it's the biggest city in the world, it's the capital, they're in the centre of a culture that they also dominate. It's probably quite hard to think that you need to adjust your thinking in order to win people over.
It's a really good point. I think you actually see the start of this in 97. I think Labour win a lot of seats in London for the first time. And you see, you know, demographics have changed. So London now is, there's, like, you know, people say there's a lot more renters than homeowners. There's a lot more people in secure work than in those areas that kind of voted Leave and voted Tory the last election. So it's not just a case of London being out of touch with the rest of the country. I think there's a message you can give to Londoners that you could give to the rest of the country. I think the bigger problem for Labour is that it is obviously consists of a lot of politicians and advisors, probably, who, you know, not only live in London but went to university, get a job in politics, and are very good at what, you know, what they do, but in reality who are the people, you know, where are the working class people, what are the routes into the parliament now, where are the Leave voting Labour candidates? I mean, we live in a country that was 52-48. To my knowledge, there's probably three Labour MPs that voted Leave, if that, and I think a couple of them lost. I mean, that's fine as well. Like, I'm not saying that it should be a prerequisite for the party that you have to have such views, but if you're trying to govern the country and you're trying to go out and win new areas and win back those areas, who's going to be able to speak for the party and say that they understand it?
So do you think
people like that? I think people, someone like Andy Burnham, for example, is a really good example of a politician who has changed and moved away from, he said it himself, when he was just working in Westminster and he, you know, was in that kind of bubble and he was doing, you know, he's doing the politics. He had certain views and he thought this is how it's done. And then when he lost to Corbyn, he realised that he wanted to be a little bit more true to himself and a little bit more representative of his background in the Northwest, and he came from a seat in Lee that Labour lost. When we were winning in 97, Lee was not a sort of area that Labour had to worry about. Didn't have to frame its message to those towns. It absolutely has to now. That's the sort of place that if it doesn't win back, it can't govern again.
I guess my question then is, we earlier talked about, you know, how Blair was able to get a hearing from the right-wing press and how the Labour Party let him triangulate. They let him try and outflank Conservatives on the right. They let him do his messaging. At this point, I wonder, I guess the follow-up question is the right-wing press ever going to give Labour a hearing in the way it gave Blair? And is the left-wing Labour Party membership and parliamentary party ever going to let a Labour leader do that kind of messaging again?
That is the fundamental problem at the heart of Labour's issues for the last decade, I think. And it's one that just isn't, that we just don't know. It's not the fact that I don't think the membership is a problem for Labour. It elected Keir Starmer, and it would, you know, I think it would elect someone who could win an election. You know, Jeremy Corbyn could have won a general election, I believe, but he had to present himself in a way and make an argument that was more convincing to the country. I think it's about the way that you shape your, you know, argument to the electorate as much as it is about moving left or right and moving with the times. I think at the minute, Labour, the media problem, I don't think is its main problem. I think the Brexit problem is still the main problem. I think it will be open to massive attacks at the next election that it hasn't solved this issue that was so problematic. And the media aren't going to let them get away with that as well. So I think until Keir Starmer is going into these right-wing outlets and saying, we are not going to overturn that referendum result, and these are the things that we are going to do under Labour levelling up, that people who left the party can see and go, the party has changed on this issue. Then it doesn't matter what they say on other things. I think it doesn't matter who you get as leader and it does matter because the person's got to do it. But I think that winning over the voters it lost has to come first, and then you worry about how the media framed that.
That sounds very sensible, but I think how silly Labour politics has got since, like, this point. You know, I think sometimes political commentators, you know, one sits around and you talk as if we were still living in this world in which people were making rational political decisions, and they were thinking about winning elections and thinking about the ordinary person on the street. And some of the time they're doing that, but then you also see times where you've got a Labour leader going on the radio and stumbling around about how you define a biological woman or something. And it's like, how are you not able to just, you know, I'm not saying that they should be fighting the culture war or that this is what voters care about, but if you're not able to even say something, to say the kind of sensible thing that most people think, which is like, you know, what most people probably want to hear from the Labour leader is, of course, we support trans people's rights. No, we don't want, no, of course, we know what a biological woman is. Move on.
I think the fact
he's not able to do that anymore in the modern Labour Party, he doesn't feel able to do that. You know, the fact that he got so captivated by something like the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, these are issues that our media care about on the left. They're not, and the right in a negative sense, they're not what anyone in the country is thinking about on a day-to-day basis.
I think I'm not so sure about that as in terms of it, that those things matter to the wider electorate. But I think there is a problem in the sense that Labour get themselves into these positions where they kind of get caught up not being able to answer, you know, those questions. So, like, say, for example, you know, where does it fit into the wider strategy when someone is going out and defending Black Lives Matter or talking about trans issues? There needs to be, you need to have a concrete policy position and a concrete message around it, whatever that is. And you, I don't think you can fudge the issues for too long. And again, back to Brexit, I still think they're trying to fudge the issue and not talk about it. And I think by not talking about it, they, I personally believe, and it's the same with the Scotland issue, I've helped write a thing for Labour in Communications about what it needs to do to kind of help its message over the next election, which will be coming out tomorrow. One of the questions that will come up in the next election is, who's Labour going to do a deal with? Because it's unlikely that they're going to win outright. So hung parliament territory is definitely where Labour are. SNP, Lib Dem, the attacks are going to be, you get these three parties together and they're going to overturn the referendum result. They're going to be X, Y, Z, all the cultural issues that you talk about. And I think Labour, and Tony Blair has said this himself, rather than just trying to avoid those issues, go straight into it head on with your own views in a strong manner and try and win people around.
What would those views be? I mean, that becomes the problem, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that comes back to the problem, I think, that we might be a few years out from an election, but I still think why the Labour Party is ahead in the polls, and Wakefield is going to be a really good test by-election. If they, you know, win by 15 to 20%, and there's a clear evidence that there's both unpopularity with this government and a real groundswell for Labour to win again, then, you know, much of this conversation will probably be kind of redundant. They're like very much got a clear perception in people's minds, but I agree with you. I think the general public still don't really know where Labour stand on a whole range of issues. And yes, the windfall tax, you know, what you might call a retail offer, which they did in 97, but a new Labour nostalgia in that one, is a good policy that you can go out and say, here's how much you're going to get in your pocket. I think it was David Axelrod who said when he was working with Ed Miliband, they need to get away from vote Labour, win a microwave. And this is what it kind of is at the minute. It's like vote Labour, get £600 tomorrow. Okay, great. But what about Brexit? What about all the other issues that are coming down the track? The long-term education policy, rest of it. Labour may have these policies and I know they're working on them, but take it down to the pub and say, okay, what do you think of Keir Starmer?
One thing to say, they need to have a policy. But the thing about Blair is, and he didn't just have a policy, he had policies that are actually popular and actually reflected people's lives. So he said he understood how crime affected working class communities, and he talks about that. But now you've got a Labour Party. Like, it would be great, like, you know, at the moment, you know, I mean, you know, even Jeremy Corbyn was able to kind of say we need more police. But I wonder now if we're actually at a point where there are a lot of Labour MPs who are quietly buying into prison abolition. You know, it's like, I mean, you may say these are people are crazy, they don't represent the Labour Party. That this is even a conversation that's being had in the Labour Party, the fact that you're even able to say that in the Labour Party and stay in the Labour Party, I mean, that tells you that that's going to kill Labour at the next election, if there's even a hint of that at a time when people are having to deal with it.
They'll certainly try. They'll certainly try and say that there are people within the party.
They shouldn't be able to do that. They weren't able to do that in 97. They're going to be able to do it now.
But I think what happened with Blair in 97 was he did want some kind of people around that said those things so he could say they're on the outer of the party.
That's it.
As I said, when Scargill set up his own political party after Blair said he got rid of Close Four, he was like, that's the best thing that could possibly happen to us.
Is Keir Starmer going to be able to do that? That's the question.
Well, if Jeremy Corbyn runs against him in Islington, he can make a clear divide and say this is not the party that it once was. But I don't actually think that that's what he'll want to do. And I don't think Labour really need to go down a route of a massive civil war about this. I think bringing it back to your point about the policies of 97, I think they were reflective of that time and they were reflective of a period. Starmer needs to find policies that are reflective of this age. Yeah. They may well be bigger than what Blair was doing in 97. So I don't think it's about going back to centre ground at all. I think there's definitely space to kind of be bigger and more to the left on policy and go for it. But I think, bringing it back to your initial point about crime, I think this is where the problem would lie for Labour at the minute. You believe, from your exertions, that this trend within Labour for the abolition of prisons, on the left of the party, all they talk about is why, how Keir Starmer is a massive conservative on crime, because he's got a few posters that say Labour are going to be tough on crime, that they've talked about. I can't remember the exact policies now, but there's like some community inventions that people have said are quite conservative. So I think this is the problem that Labour have got. Can't appeal to anyone on this one. On the right, people are like, you're too soft on crime. On the left, you're being too conservative. Yeah. I think that comes from the position of it's not really understood yet. I think if you actually went to my local pub and said, what's Labour's position on crime? I think they'd be more likely to do what you say and repeat something that they read in the newspaper about the abolition of prison or whatever. And that could be a massive problem. Even if it's not true, I think it could be a massive problem. As you say, Starmer needs to find a way to kind of show that it's not where he stands.
And again, the other problem that Labour faces is that they've been out in opposition so long, they haven't had to shape their positions to reality. And the problem is that the Labour politicians who actually are in power, you know, someone like Sadiq Khan, are not necessarily great advertisements for the whole country, you know. I mean, Sadiq Khan is someone that the right-wing press has gone after in a very big way. You may say that's unfair or not, but I'm not sure that Labour's local government has always been, is exactly kind of won people over.
Yeah, I think it comes back to, obviously the Brexit issue is involved in that. And I don't think it's about, I've ended up talking a lot about Brexit on this. I don't want it to be like Labour needs to massively change their lifelong positions on things. I don't think they do, but I do think there needs to be a kind of, there's a big problem in the way that the kind of Labour fought back against Brexit that will last for many, many, many years. I don't think there's any way of getting around that. The fact that a lot of people believed that we voted this way and we wanted this thing to happen, and Labour politicians became, rightly or wrongly, the kind of front men, whether it's Alistair Campbell, whether it was David Lammy or Sadiq Khan or whoever, became the shorthand for the people who wanted to stop Brexit. And while we still live in the kind of post-Brexit era where these things matter to people and you can frame things through the culture war of Brexit, whether it's, you know, graduates v non-graduates, people who, you know, own houses who might have voted Leave versus renters who vote Remain in London, while it's still fought on those terms, Labour are really going to struggle. They're going to really struggle. And it's, again, it's harder for Keir Starmer than it was for Tony Blair. Tony Blair could go and pitch to Middle England and say, we've done all these changes to our policy and win them over. Didn't have to worry about alienating Scotland and the so-called Red Wall. He did have people like John Prescott around that could help him with that message. Keir Starmer doesn't have a big beast in the north that can help him, like a, you know, traditional person who could, you know, we need to win this by-election in Wakefield, right, send X. You know, I don't think, you know, Andy Burnham potentially could be the person, but, you know, Starmer's got to worry about Burnham taking his job. You know what I mean? Like, he can't bring him in and be like, you're going to be the guy who wins about these areas. So there's a lot of politics going on that there wasn't there in 97 for Tony Blair. But I think you're right. I think they need to do some rebranding in those areas to kind of win those voters back, if that's what it decides to do. If it's, because Starmer's made a huge play of winning back traditional Labour voters who voted Leave and voted Conservative. I don't think there's a massive strategy in place to win those back at the moment. You know, we lost Hartlepool, Batley was a struggle, Wakefield will be interesting. I think if you want to have a kind of more progressive left coalition, which is what more Jeremy Corbyn wanted to do, and potentially win more seats in Scotland, win Green voters, win Lib Dems, it's a very different strategy and a different message.
Yeah. Well, I think, is there anything else we should cover? Yes, I mean, just one more thing before we finish up. I wonder if you make anything of some of the demographic changes. So the 1997 election was, at that point, before the election, older people, younger people were more evenly divided between Labour and Conservative. Conservatives were still able to win over young voters. It was also a far whiter country. Since that election, there's a far more diverse population out there that's voting. You've got issues like, you know, suddenly politicians have to care about issues like Palestine and India in their own, when they kind of get elected for leader. It's a very different environment. And I think also class, which still played a very big part in the 1997 election, has become much more complicated. It's not gone, but it's changed. So do you think that the next what do you make of the very different electorate that's going to wait the next election?
It's a really good point, and it's also, I think we're seeing moving towards a more, what would you call it, a localized model. I think the leader is becoming less important than it was in the 90s, bizarrely. I think you're getting candidates selected in local areas that are very unique to that local area. They, you know, who have very specific issues that they can campaign on. In that sense, you call them minority issues or you call them fringe issues or whatever you want to call them, you can actually still win with candidates that are fighting very specific targeted election. I think the point more broadly is that whether Labour like it or not, the route back to power is to win over Conservative voters. It always has been. And it was the same for Margaret Thatcher in the 1970s. She had to win over Labour voters, people who just, David Cameron had to go out and win back people who hadn't voted Conservative for years. Starmer's task is very simple. He has to get people who voted Conservative and Lib Dem and others to vote Labour. And so you have to fundamentally change the image of the party in that individual voter's mind. It's a very hard job to do. And like you say, there's so many different competing arguments now that what's good for one person might not be good for another. But that's probably why you need a balanced team. And let's bring it back, round it up on Brexit, because we talked about it a lot. Labour still dominated by people who voted Remain. Not that there's anything wrong with that per se, but in the image of image of the voters' mind, they still look like the party that they were under Ed Miliband.
I mean, if you talk to some people in Labour, they'll say, well, if we wait long enough, we're going to be in power forever, because if you look at the polls, some ridiculous proportion of young people vote Labour. Some absurd proportion of the Conservative electorate is over 60. In 28 years, not to put too fine a point on it, will the Conservative electorate exist?
It's a good point, and it might not. But at the same time, people argue that the Labour Party won't exist because it doesn't have its roots anymore in Scotland and the Red Wall that it can build out from. So it's building a new coalition, which, like you say, is based on cities and university graduates. And although there's more university students, is that enough to create a political party that is going to dominate? What the thing that Conservatives have in their favour is that the electoral map favours them. They can win easier in some ways than Labour can, particularly in England. Labour are going to struggle to win a majority just on England and England and Wales. So I don't know. The death of political parties is something that comes back again and again and again. I think in 2005, was it Geoffrey Wheatcroft or someone wrote the strange death of Conservative Britain? And you know what I mean? It's like, and the strange death of Tory England or whatever. And it's like, people genuinely did believe in the early 2000s, after 2001, that the Conservative Party was finished.
Yeah.
Wasn't suitable for the modern age. I think The Sun said it was like Marks and Spencer's. It was gone. It was a golden era of the 20th century, and it wasn't going to come back. It obviously came back, and now it doesn't look like it's ever been away. You know, if you have to be, how old do you have to be now to have lived under a Labour government? You know, there's a lot of people now who are, you know, coming of age and voting, you've never known anything but Conservative government. Mm-hmm. It's getting back to that point. So whether political parties survive or not, I don't know. I think people always want change. Something will replace the Conservative government soon, not sooner rather than later. I say soon. Soon in terms of our lives, maybe not in terms of electoral cycles.
Oh, Anthony Brox, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.